underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. As host of The Lead and State of the Union on CNN, Jake Tapper spends his days bringing attention to some of the biggest political headlines. Tapper has now brought Washington intrigue and the swampiness of the city to his first novel. The Hellfire Club is a political thriller that takes place during the days when Senator Joe McCarthy was carrying out his communist witch hunt. We meet Charlie Martyr, an unlikely congressman, thrust into office by his family ties after his predecessor died mysteriously. Charlie is struggling to navigate the dangerous waters of 1950s Washington, D.C., alongside his young wife, Margaret, a zoologist with ambitions of her own. Again, the new novel is The Hellfire Club. It is a great pleasure to welcome Jake Tapper to this week's book show. How are you, sir?
I'm good, Joe. Thanks so much for having me.
Very nice to have you on the program. I can't begin to tell you how much I enjoyed reading this novel. I find this to be a fascinating time in American history, and yet I didn't know a whole lot about it.
Well, that's exactly what I went through when I was researching it. I knew of Joe McCarthy and I knew of McCarthyism, but there were a lot of details I didn't know about, and I put a lot of research into it. And one of the fun things I hope for readers is figuring out, and there's a whole bunch of endnotes at the end of the book, what is real and what is not real. A lot of the more bizarre events that take place in the book are actually real events and real people, in addition to the fictitious plot of swampiness and intrigue and secret societies and conspiracies.
It takes place almost 10 years after the war. It's right before Brown versus Board of Education. It's a very specific time in history. What brought you to that moment?
Early 1954. The 50s, to me, are an era that is, I think, underreported, undercovered in popular culture. They are depicted, especially for people of a certain age, such as you and I, they're depicted as benign, happy days, American graffiti, a time of economic boom, idyllic, serene. But the truth is, the 50s were a horrible time in this country in a lot of ways, in addition, obviously, to the racism and sexism of American society at the time. Right underneath the veneer of American civilization, corporations were running amok. With that economic boom, communists were infiltrating the government. McCarthy and the Red Scare were prevalent, with very few people in Washington standing up against the indecency and the lies and smears of McCarthy. There were bizarre events going on, Puerto Rican separatists bursting into Congress, opening fire and shooting five members of Congress, the U.S. Senate holding hearings into comic books and how comic books were responsible for juvenile delinquency. In addition, obviously, there was the atomic race. So there was a lot going on that made this era, I felt, ripe for fiction. And, you know, in the 50s kind of don't get a lot of attention because they're sandwiched between World War II, which was obviously an incredible period of world history, and the 60s, which was incredible tumult and demands for freedom and equality. So that's why I said it there. And it was just so ripe for fiction because there were so many actual events going on that were real and hard to believe.
The parallels to today, you started this prior to the election?
I did. I started about 3 or 4 years ago in terms of writing and outlining, yeah.
So then that just became, became more attuned to the parallels as you went on.
Yeah, I mean, the swampiness of Washington was there before Donald Trump made the swamp a campaign issue. The resonance of McCarthyism to today exists independent of me, independent of my research. I mean, they say history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. You can't read about the 50s and how Joe McCarthy lied and smeared and behaved indecently in order to achieve his political ends with very few people standing up to him in the press or in public life. You can't read about that without hearing that echoing, without hearing that rhyming to what President Trump does today, who he tells a lot of lies and he smears a lot of people and he behaves indecently on occasion. And very few people in Washington are willing to stand up to him. Just a few days ago, all these U.S. senators, all these Republicans were telling us, the media, reporters, how offended they were by the White House aide who made a joke about John McCain dying of brain cancer. They didn't think it was funny. They thought the White House owed him an apology, et cetera. And then these Republican senators met with President Trump and not one of them raised it. There's a lot of rhyming. That's what happened with McCarthy, too. I mean, people didn't stand up to him, not enough anyway. And so I played it up a little bit in the writing that took place in 2016, 2017, but it was already there.
And what about with Roy Cohn? Because, of course, Roy Cohn is such a part of the McCarthy story and yet such a part of the Trump story as well.
That's right. I mean, Joe McCarthy's protege was Roy Cohn. Roy Cohn's protege was Donald Trump. And there's a lot of connective tissue. I have to say, though, Roy Cohn became a bigger character in the book as I wrote it, not because of Donald Trump, but because he is such a deliciously evil person in real life. And the scene that took place in the book where Charlie is arguing, Charlie goes to a party at the Mayflower thrown by Conrad Hilton, and he meets Roy Cohn and they get into an argument. And that scene was so fun to write that I added another, and then I added a couple more scenes with Joe McCarthy. But that didn't have to do with Donald Trump. That just had to do with how fun it was to write Roy Cohn dialogue.
And evil was fun to write.
Evil is fun to write, and also not, he was smart, and McCarthy was charismatic. I mean, they had attributes that I thought needed to be played up. I didn't want to portray them just as pure evil with nothing else going for it.
You make that case a couple of times in the book that this guy, what he was doing was awful, but he wasn't a jerk outwardly. He was an interesting sort.
Joe McCarthy and Roy Cohn had qualities to them. They were both evil people, but, you know, Joe McCarthy was a self-made man who capitalized on a political phenomenon. What he did was awful, and I'm not defending it, but he had a real charisma. He had a real talent. He was skillful in his oratory. Likewise, Roy Cohn was brilliant and ruthless. To portray them just as mindless idiots who were evil would be a disservice to who they were and also a disservice to understanding how it is that evil things are allowed to happen in this country.
Jake Tapper is our guest. The new novel is The Hellfire Club. It is published by Little Brown. So in the novel, we meet Charlie Martyr. He is a congressman. He is thrust into office by his family ties, those of his father. Tell us a little bit about how Charlie gets the job and how he learns his ways, the ways of Washington, very quickly.
Well, this is a flight of fiction because in actuality, when a member of Congress dies, there's a special election. For the purposes of this book, I made it so what would happen in 1954 was a governor would appoint somebody. So I have heard from both Newt Gingrich and Cokie Roberts objecting to that literary license that I took. And you know, I respect them a lot, and I appreciated them reaching out. That is in the end notes, by the way. I know the rules of Congress, but I thought most people don't and most people won't care. So Charlie gets appointed to the seat because his dad is a power broker. He's a historian and a World War II hero. He moves down to Washington with his wife, Margaret, who's a zoologist. And part of the selling point to her is she's fascinated with these ponies that live in Maryland, these wild ponies, and she'll be closer to them and able to study them. And so they move down to Washington. And as Margaret goes and studies these ponies, they are both also studying the creatures of Washington, D.C., and trying to understand how these wild animals behave.
What was your interest in the ponies prior to the writing of this novel? Was that something that you were interested in?
You know, I've always, there are these, obviously there are these wild ponies in Assateague and Chincoteague Islands in Maryland and Virginia. And these ponies in the book are based on those. I made up islands, Susquehannock and Nanticoke Islands. But I just always thought it was fascinating that there is this mystery in the United States. Nobody knows where these wild ponies come from, per se. It's thought that it's from the sinking of a Spanish galleon in the 1700s, but nobody really knows. And there are these wild ponies, and I've visited them with my family, and they're really cool. I also thought that I wanted Margaret to be an independent person. I didn't want her just to be the wife at home. I wanted her to be strong. I wanted her to have her own opinions. I wanted to have her be kind of the conscience of the family while Charlie's trying to negotiate this world. And having her have this independent career, I thought would be a good way to illustrate this, while at the same time the ponies are ripe for metaphor. And then also, I thought it would be fun, and I don't want to spoil any parts of the book, but I thought it would be fun to have a dramatic scene take place on an island in the middle of a storm where there are wild animals running around.
And really, her only vulnerability at this particular time is that she's pregnant.
She's pregnant, and that was one of the you know, I had a lot of women who helped me write this book, including my wife and including my editor, Reagan Arthur, and what Margaret would be able to do while pregnant, and obviously she gets more and more pregnant as the book goes on, was something that I had to consult. She and Charlie are starting out a family, and it was important to me to have Margaret be a strong person and not have her just be this nag or shrew, or not just have Charlie be single and have him bedding women left and right, as often happens in thrillers. I wanted to have him be married to a strong woman, and I wanted their marriage to have an arc of its own. I wanted their relationship to be romantic in the way that Dashiell Hammett and Nick, when he would write about Nick and Nora. I wanted the idea of a romance and a married couple to be part of the book.
He is a soldier. He comes out of the war suffering what we would now call PTSD. And also, she is helping him through, prior to becoming a congressman, he is a best-selling author with a nonfiction history book that she basically helps him with.
Yeah, she helped edit his book. He's an academic who studied the colonial American period. Which becomes relevant to the book, to the plot, because Sons of Liberty is the book he wrote. His interest in that period of time and his ability to do research and academic research helps him crack the case and helps him understand the conspiracy that they're in, which is the title of the book, The Hellfire Club, which is, as you know, it was a real secret society in England in the 1700s, where people in the royal family and politicians and business people would all go to this estate outside of London and engage in the most debaucherous behavior with mock satanic rituals and orgies. And it really was the elite of London, including Benjamin Franklin, who participated in this. And one of the conceits of the novel is, what if that secret society from the 18th century in England were in the United States in the 1950s?
And as you say, you point this out in the book of what is true and what is not. But when it comes to those secret societies in Washington, how prevalent are they? How prevalent were they then? How prevalent are they now?
The truth is, I don't know. The idea that there are secret societies, there are some that we have heard a little bit about, right? There's Bohemian Grove, there's a Bilderberg. We hear whispers about secret societies here and there. I don't have any. If I had enough to write a nonfiction book about secret societies, I would. I can tell you that based on what I know of powerful, rich men, it seems inconceivable to me that there aren't secret societies. You know, you can't pick up a newspaper or turn on NPR without hearing about some incredibly rich, powerful man who thought he could get away with horrific behavior finally being brought down. But I don't know of any. I write about a few in the book, but I don't have any evidence that they exist. But for me, it was a literary device to help explain the swampiness of Washington, D.C., both in the 50s and today, which is why, for instance, why would Ambassador Joe Kennedy, this really happened, why would he be able to reach out to Joe McCarthy in 1952 and say, hey, I don't want you to campaign against my son. You're a Republican. My son's a Democrat running for Senate in 1952 in Massachusetts. Don't campaign against my son. Why would Joe McCarthy agree to that? I don't really have an answer. That really actually happened. In the book, it's because they're part of this secret society. It was a conceit to try to explain a lot of swampiness that doesn't really lend itself to explanation beyond my fictitious theories.
But also it gives us an idea of how a person can come into Washington from the quote-unquote outside and be fundamentally changed by it.
Yeah, this was something that I wanted to convey in the book, and it's something I've lived in Washington now since the end of 1992, with 1 year in New York accepted. And it's something I see all the time, which is good men and good women, Republicans and Democrats, coming to Washington, D.C. to do good, as was the case with Charlie in this book. And little by little, they get co-opted. Little by little, they compromise their principles, not just their politics, but they compromise their principles in order to, it starts off, they do it in order to achieve an end, a good end. I want to achieve this for my constituents. I want to save these jobs. I want to help these people. In order to do that, I need to become part of this system. And then little by little, they compromise more and more and more of themselves until, you know, all of a sudden they're neck deep in swamp water and they don't know how to get out. And that was what I wanted to convey in this story with Charlie. He comes in, he wants to do good. One of the first things he wants to do is when he was in France during World War II, there were bad gas masks that hurt his platoon. And he wants to stop that company from getting a federal contract. And in order to do that, he is encouraged to do X, Y, and Z. Next thing you know, he's on a path of other compromises, and he loses sight of why he was there to begin with. And that's something that I see in our political system every year with good people either trying to buck the system and getting beaten down for it or becoming a part of it too quickly.
So when you have Charlie and other characters that you have created speaking to Senator Kennedy, Senator Kefauver, Joe McCarthy, even Conrad Hilton, what is the challenge for you as a writer to pull that off and to make those characters real and also have their truth at the center of it?
That's a really good question, and it's a complicated one because at first when I started writing it, I was less comfortable with it than I became. At first, I wanted to have real people in the book, Eisenhower, Nixon, Kennedy, Kefauver, McCarthy, Cohn, et cetera. I wanted to make sure that I captured who they were but not betray who they were in any way just for the sake of my plot. And that just became the guiding light for me, but I became more and more comfortable with it. For instance, you know, I wasn't going to have John Kennedy kill somebody in the book. I wasn't going to have Joe McCarthy kill somebody in the book. But I did want to have them do things that the reader would believe. I wanted to have Senator Kefauver, who a lot of people don't even know about. He was an incredibly important U.S. senator at the time. He's a Democrat from Tennessee. He'd run for president in 1952, basically swept the primaries, but because nominations were decided in smoke-filled back rooms, he got screwed out of it, and Adlai Stevenson was nominated instead. He was a real character, and I wanted to try to capture who he was in a way that would service the plot and be entertaining for people. It was just a line to walk. You know, you want to service the plot, you want to be fair to the characters, but you also have to take some literary license because obviously Senator Kefauver never met Charlie Martyr because Charlie Martyr is not a real person.
When you think, though, of was there any idea as to who Charlie Martyr would be like?
The truth is that I kind of just thought of Charlie Martyr as representing the innocence of America in 1954.
He comes from Manhattan.
He's a World War II hero. He enlisted. He's a good person. He's an honorable person. He's kind of unaware of how pampered he's been his whole life. He's fundamentally decent, war-weary, believes in the fundamental goodness of America, but maybe a little too naive. And he kind of is a stand-in for the United States of America in a way. Like I wanted him to. This is what a person might be like. I actually tried writing this book set in the 1700s, and that didn't work. And then I tried setting it in the modern day, and that didn't work either. And one of the reasons why it didn't work is because the character of Charlie, who is eminently decent but also flawed and naive, he didn't work in 2018. He was just too naive in 2018. But it fit more in 1954. So that's who he is. The only two things I have in common with Charlie are Charlie's married to a much stronger, better person, which is I am. And Charlie has this very keen sense of smell, which is something that both my brother and I have been cursed with as well. These olfactory gifts that are not particularly gifts.
When did you notice that?
Oh, I just probably in high school or college, as my brother and I started talking about how good our sense of smell was and how much we could detect things that were going on that other people were not aware of.
And you give Charlie this gift or curse, but it plays a role in the novel as well.
Yeah, no, it's not just thrown in. Again, I don't want to spoil anything, but his ability to smell, his ability to detect a scent in the air does become important to the plot.
Let's talk just for a moment about the swampiness. We talk about how people can get then sucked into it, but do you get a sense that it has always been a place of swampiness just by the way it was created by the founding fathers?
Yeah, I do. You know, but there is a difference between the backroom deals between, you know, Alexander Hamilton and trying to, you know, figure out where the Federal Reserve Bank is versus where the U.S. Capitol is and that kind of quid pro quo, and versus people, you know, selling votes or doing things for money, which is very much part of our political system these days. Probably it was worse in 1954 than now because of the post-Watergate reforms. But the truth is that people in Washington, politicians, do a lot of things because their contributors want them to do them, for good or for ill. And that's part of our system. And it's about as swampy as it gets, and it continues today.
When you say that it was perhaps worse in 54, the idea here, we see a lot of corporations having a great effect on what was happening at that time.
Yeah, and that still happens today. The reason why I think it's probably worse then, although there's a lot more money in it today, is because the ideas of accountability and transparency were so much more modest then than they are today. And believe it or not, the media is much more aggressive today than it was in 1954. Mm. I mean, the media back then helped politicians cover things up. And whatever complaints people have about the media, we are a lot more aggressive today than we were back then.
Did you consciously not write a lot about the media in the novel?
Well, I just tried to look at it from the perspective of Charlie, and Charlie is a congressman, and he doesn't really think all that highly of the media. So, I mean, that's most members of Congress I know feel that way. And there are a couple conversations about the media, but basically the media is not regarded all that well. There is one character, Isaiah Street, is a Tuskegee Airman and a member of Congress, and his wife, Renee, is a big fan of a certain newsman. And Charlie does watch the Edward R. Murrow program when he eviscerates McCarthy. But as a general note, I thought it would be insincere and to have a book about a member of Congress with a reporter having a big role, because members of Congress don't really like reporters, and we wouldn't really play a role with them.
Would you think about, and I guess I'm just thinking about the writer aspect of it, of having your piece of it in the sense of defending the profession, perhaps?
Well, there is this paragraph when Charlie's watching Murrow go after McCarthy, and he's thinking to himself how it's a little late. It's a little late for Murrow to be going after McCarthy, that Senator Margaret J. Smith went after McCarthy in 1950, and there were other journalists that went after McCarthy in 52. The cartoonist Walt Kelly and the comic strip Pogo went after McCarthy in 1953. Why did it take Edward R. Murrow so long to do it? You know, that's Charlie's perspective. I guess my point was, you know, I wasn't writing this book to defend journalism. It felt like it would be a little cliche, you know, if the book were about a crusading young journalist, for example, I just tried to write a different book. And the truth of the matter is, I don't think a member of Congress would have much respect for the press.
Will you write more novels?
The reception's been pretty good for this one. You know, we made the Times bestseller list for a few weeks, and things are going well. So, I mean, I think I need to take a break spend a little time with my wife and our kids. But I would be psyched to write another one, especially with these characters. I like Charlie and Margaret. I think they're a good couple. I think they're an interesting people. And it was fun to research 1954 and to write about it. There are other parts of that era. There's a time in 1962 when President Kennedy is thinking about visiting Los Angeles, and Frank Sinatra is desperately trying to convince him to stay with him in Los Angeles. And Robert Kennedy, the Attorney General, this is true, Robert Kennedy, the Attorney General, ultimately decides, no, you can't stay with Frank Sinatra because he has too many mob ties. And he goes, and Kennedy stays with the Hollywood's number one Republican, Bing Crosby, instead. which sends a Sinatra into a tailspin. He gets so upset. That's just a fascinating story, and that might be fun, and then I could write about politics and the Rat Pack at the same time. So maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I want to read that.
Yeah.
That's a lot of fun.
I think it'd be fun.
Jake Tapper's new novel is The Hellfire Club. It is published by Little Brown. Great pleasure having you on the book show.
Oh, it was so much fun. Thanks so much.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can also listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.